teacher, and it was one of those small classes where you had 12 people. And in that process, you go to see her in an interview. And the interview that we had began this way. She looked at me and said, "You're not a poet." She wasn't as polite as Adam was about it. She said, "You're not a poet. What are you?" And I said, "I'm a painter." And she said, "Well, we'll have to figure out how to get you credit for this course." And I didn't know at the time, but she was a watercolorist. And so she had a great love of art. And she wrote out a portion of The Fish for me. And that, over the years and years, that's the one piece I've lost. And it's so fitting because Elizabeth was such an elusive woman. She would always say she's going to do a reading, and then you'd go to the reading and she wouldn't show up. And in a sense, it's like the fish that she put back in the ocean, and it's like the piece that I did that began the whole process went back to the ocean. So I don't have her piece, but I do have the other ones. And it was a fun relationship I had with her because we made a pact. She, in her apartment down in Lewis Wharf, said to me, "Why don't you just come down and we'll have tea, we'll play backgammon, and we won't talk about poetry." And in that basis, we became friends. And we talked about art and life and everything else that she didn't, in that moment, have to talk about poetry, which was always what people wanted her to be doing and talking about. So the second person that I went to was Robert Lowell. And what I've tried to do in the work I've done is the words are one thing and the personality of the poet is another. And I've tried to find something that would allow for bringing forward something of the character of the poet as well as what the words say. And he gave me the opening lines of his poem called Man and Wife. And it's quite a striking poem. And the beginning of it is, "Tamed by Milltown, we lay on mother's bed." And it goes on. It's in the catalog, and they are in the back. I won't read this one. But there's a sort of submerged violence in the film, in the poem, which is what gave me the idea of using the room and the bed. And he's a childlike man, so the stick figures which are on the bed seem to me to represent a little bit of that, of him. And the blue and the dark around it embodying that sense of sort of a held back and restrained violence which is in the poem. And he did this in a restaurant, he decided, one called the Iruña Spanish restaurant. And he wrote out these words, and he had a rather maniacal laugh. And he said, "Here, take this, have fun with that." And then after him, it was Octavio Paz, who was the Mexican man who was became a Nobel laureate. And when I showed him Paz's, Lowell's work and Bishop's work, he said, "Oh, they've written too small. And could I write in Spanish? And can I write big?" So that I said, "Fine," because one of the rules for the game on which I was playing was that I would use everything I was given by the poet, sometimes little notes, sometimes whatever pieces came to me. So when I went to pick up the piece from him, I had a drink with he and his wife. And when I was having the drink, he said, "I made a spelling mistake. And is that acceptable?" And I said, "Yeah, that's fine." But his wife said, "No, that's no good. Do it over for the young man." So you can see the spelling mistake on the left where the dark line is. So he gave me these two pieces of paper saying, "If you make a mistake with one, you have the other." And it took me a year to figure out how I was going to use them both, because I knew I would. And so I ripped up the poem that had the spelling error in it and used it as the forming of the poem or the dissolving of the poem, as everything does form and does dissolve. So after that, there's a game called Hearts. Does anybody know the game called Hearts, or is that American? Well, in the game of Hearts, if you get the Queen of Spades, the Jack of Diamonds, and the Two, you've what they call shot the moon. And I didn't realize it at the time, But what I had done by having Octavio Paz and Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop, I was able to go to other poets and they'd say, sure, I would love to participate with you. Some of them became friends and some of them weren't quite as friendly. And one of the ones that was an interesting challenge was Allen Ginsberg, and this is his piece over here. And again, I'm trying to do something which is evocative of the personality of the poet and his. So I was a young person, and I was in New York for maybe my second visit, and I called him on the phone because I had his number, and he says, hello, and I said who I was, and he said, who the fuck are you? And I said, well, I was an artist, and I wanted to collaborate with you. And he said, why the fuck would I do that? And at that point, I got a little annoyed, and I said to him, well, Octavio Paz has done this, Robert Lowell has done this, Elizabeth Bishop has done this, and if you don't want to, that's fine. And he said, why the fuck didn't you tell me that? You come down here this morning to the Lower East Side, and we'll work together. And when I was with him, he became the most fastidious person. You think of Allen Ginsberg as this free spirit and sort of everything, anything goes. But what happened when we were together was he chose the rag paper that would last the longest, and he chose the black India ink that would last forever. And what he gave me was a journal entry that had occurred just a few nights before, and I would like to read that because it's part of what the illustration has to do. One of the things that's occurred during the project is my words are not always visible, and they're not mine. They're written out by the hand of the poet. And I've never felt I had to be polite. And there's a long history of illustrations for poems, and many times the poem is way over on this side and the illustration's way on the other, never the two to meet. And I've just adopted a different attitude about it, knowing that if you know the poem and you have to see this work, you'll always remember it, you'll have a sense of the flavor of it. So this is his journal entry from July 11th, 1976. What's to be done about death? Nothing, nothing. Stop going to school in 1937. Freeze time tonight with a headache at 1:45 a.m. Not go to father's funeral tomorrow. Mourn. Not go back to Boulder. Not teach at Naropa Institute. Not be buried in the cemetery near Newark Airport someday. That's what I was given to work with. So the piece of paper that's in the collaged onto the canvas is riding in my feeling like a moon, or it's like a ghost inside of that image. And I used crayon underneath on the canvas and covered it with India ink, the way that he had, in a sense, wanted things to be so permanent. And then I scratched through to allow the light to come in to the piece. I didn't always get a chance to choose I had no chance to choose what the poet would want to write. So some are darker than others. I did become friends with this other poet. The next poet is James Merrill, and he was one of the most wonderful believers in the project. And this is a poem that he wrote about a waterfall. And what we chose to do was to decide that the words would run up the falls like it was a salmon or like blood in a vein. And the words were, now you've seen through me, sang the cataract, a fraying force but unafraid, plunge through my bath of plus and minus both, acid and base. The mind that mirrors and the hands that act, enter this inmost space. Get me by heart, my friend, and then forget, and then forget. So the image is built on blacks and whites, contrasting, and one of the things that's inside of the print is a head that I drew from a New England gravestone, and something about the naivete of it and the flatness of it seemed to fit for James. in his personality. And the second piece is of his, is from a poem called Mirabelle. And it says, "Is it the original? Are we its carbon copy? Or are we in the presence of a black twin paradise, wherein accordingly you would appear, white-winged, your own cool opposite? Oh dear." So the image, when we were talking about how I might work with it, was given to me by him when he wrote on a, he drew on a napkin. He drew the X and he said, "Man," as the X, "stands on the earth," which was the curve, "and what is above is below," so the mirrored image. And he said, "What man holds in his hands is time," which became the little line across. And again, it's an image built from the reversals that he talks about, the black twin paradise, where it starts with a white image on a black ground and comes over to a black image on a white ground. The form that I'm using to make these is called monotype, and they are a very fluid way of using an etching press to create an image. And there's something about the way that ink gets pressed into paper when you run it through a press that is totally different from how you would look if you did a drawing or a pastel, anything like that. And I love the grays that can occur when you do that in a subtractive way. So a lot of the work that you'll see starts with a black ground of ink, and then I subtract into it the image. That comes up again. W.S. Merwin, I wonder, are people familiar with these poets? No. He was our poet laureate for one time in the States, and he's an elder statesman of poetry now in the States. And I love the poem that he's given to me because it was such a prayer for the age that we live in, and I'd love to share it with you. And it goes like this. It's called Place. "On the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. What for? And the fruit, the tree that bears the fruit, is not the one that was planted. I want the tree that stands in the earth for the first time, with the sun already going down, and the water drenching its roots, in the earth full of the dead, and the clouds passing, one by one, over its leaves." So that gave me the idea of the image and the metaphor of the body. And when you use monotype, the architecture of the print is always the same because his words were reproduced in lithography. But the image could change, as it is when you come to a poem a second time, a third time, and you reread it, you see different things. And so I saw a variety of different ways of presenting it. And Bill Merwin is a very elegant man. He's a very surface-oriented person, and that's partly what gave me the idea of the flatness of using collage inside of this poem. Except there was one moment, and this occurred during the time when the Trade Centers in 2001, I thought his poem, with that prayer, "The last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree." And so I used this other kind of image to convey something about the tragedy of that. At some time later, I met this wonderful other poet, Donald Hall, who at the time when we met had just lost his wife. And it was a similar time for me. I had lost my wife. So the two of us met, and we were very sad men. And his book called Without had just come out. And my book called Talking to Angels about my wife had just come out. And there we were, these two very unhappy men, left with words between them about the women that they had loved deeply. Another Christmas. Our first Christmas together at Eagle Pond, I bought a chainsaw to cut the tree from our woodlot. Puffing with accomplishment, I set an emancipated hemlock kitty corner from the Glenwood. What will become of Perkins? And Perkins was the name of their bird. Jane asked, that was his wife, was another exquisite poet named Jane Kenyon. Jane asked when she could still speak, what will become of Perkins? 2 years later, I miss her teasing voice that razzed my grand eloquence. Perkins, dim your lights. Somebody cover Perkins's cage. All year I could do anything I wanted, any time of day or night, travel anywhere, buy anything. Therefore, I sat in my blue chair doing nothing and trying to feel nothing on this second Christmas. I fix and decorate and cherish a visible vacancy, kitty corner from the Glenwood. Sometimes I dream awake. Sometimes I see her face in its strong-featured beauty with her eyes full of pity. These are in the space opposite us in the Heritage Center. You'll see some of the other images. And again, using a variety of ghost images, I was able to come to a place where I felt I was representing something that had been in his life and something that was now gone. This is a young woman poet named Deborah Waringa. And her poem had something to do with Adam and Eve. It's called Self-Portrait of Eve. I never use a peeler. I prefer the frisson of a paring knife chasing my thumb around the equator of a red-green globe. I'm a risk-starved wife peeling apples for a son who insists on naked fruit. I eat snaky coil of skin, and he says I'm disgusting, then kisses me on the mouth. I'd do it again, marry the man, carry the sons. I'd eat the whole Macintosh, seeds and all. But I keep an eye peeled for that serpent. I'm yearning for another fall and waiting for new fruit to grow. There's something else I need to know. And this shows you the way in which the ghost image can be used. The first one was stronger, the second one is more the ghost. And then the variety of opportunity to use different illustrations. Richard Howard was a man, another New York poet, and his poem is about a dock on the west side of New York where gay men would go prior to AIDS, and that poem is illustrated over there, and the balustrade that I've put into that, to me, represented what happened later when AIDS came and wiped out a whole generation of people. And his poem is about the ghosts that haunt that place. And it was very well received. It's been used a lot to promote raising money for AIDS. There was a man named William Meredith, and when I came to William, he was an older man. He'd had a stroke, and he said, I very much want to participate in your project. It'll just take me longer to write it out. And It took him 2 hours to write down his poem called Airman's Virtue, which was after a poem by George Herbert called Virtu. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, but it's a lovely poem, and this is his modern rendition of that. High plain for whom the winds incline, who own but to your own recall, there is a flaw in your design, for you must fall. High cloud whose proud and angry stuff rose up in heat against earth's thrall, the nodding law has time enough to wait your fall. High sky full of high shape and vapors, against whose vault nothing is tall, it is written that your torch and tapers headlong shall fall. Only an outward aching soul can hold in high disdain these ties, and fixing on a farther pole will sheerly rise. He was a fighter pilot in the Second World War in the Pacific Ocean, and this image came from that, although my jets were much more modern than the jets he would have flown in the Second World War, but they were what I drew in my art class. And I remember drawing them as a 6 or 7 year old child, and the teacher, Mrs. Barstow, who was to me at that age ancient, came over to my desk to say, "That's not the way they look. This isn't real." And I'm looking up at her with her blue rinsed hair, looking at her thinking, "That doesn't look real either." But I didn't say it. And again, you get the variation of the opportunity to play with the words and give something of the sense of how you might interpret them. And I always love the thought that this project brought poems out from the inside of books. We love poems, we love printed books, but often poems are just buried in there. And so the idea of this was to bring them out and put them on a wall and have people see them in a way that they wouldn't ever be seen if they stayed inside of the book. And I feel that the intimacy that's created with the handwriting of the poet, that's another really important element for me. I love intimacy. I love the poetry that we read that is intimate, and the two together to me tell something about that poet, about that particular poem. Now, this man, Frank Bidart, was working with Robert Lowell at the time I met him, and he was a very, very nervous gentleman, and he gave me these two lines from a long poem about the dancer Nijinsky, and the poem's words are, "Trying to appease my hunger with food is like trying to stop thirst with ink." And he'd only written it out down in the lower corner, and I only had his one sheet to work with, and I didn't want to make a mistake, so I spent a long time thinking about how would you resolve something like that? How would you represent it? And I came to finally loading a brush with India ink and making one pass and another pass, and that became the resolution of what to do with the words, and then the watercolor I added later, dropping it in. And he was very pleased with it. He was stunned. He said, "I didn't know how you would do this." Now, all the poets have been very curious about how this would look when I finished. And there hasn't been one who's really objected and said, "No, I won't take that," and ripped it up or something. My Son and Another Place. This is by a man named Mark Strand, and he'd been an art student as a younger man. And this is a piece that's on exhibit in the Shell Gallery. And he lined out each of his stanzas with a little line on the side. And then he too, like Octavio Paz, he said, "I'm going to write something on the back of this sheet so that if you make a mistake, you can turn it over and you'll have the other poem to work with." And again, the rules for my game was, I can't do that. I got to use everything. And it took a long time to figure out, now how am I going to get both poems not readable, but at least on the same side of the page. And I did it with pastel by putting pastel all over a sheet of paper, laying the poem down backwards and then etching over the words of the second poem so that when I pulled the paper up, they became the other half of this column. Pretty esoteric, isn't it? That's how that was resolved. And then there was Sandy McClatchy, who knew that I was living near a park in southern Utah at the time called Zion. And he gave me a beautiful section from a longer poem about Zion Park, which is where I was living. And we made about 60 of these variations. And what was wonderful was we hung them all once. I would love to have a whole wall of these swallows that go with the following words. Zion, twin cloud mesas abut Angel's Landing. Angel's Landing is 1,500 foot high climb, and you look down. And the twin cloud mesas abut the Angel's Landing. As the sun slips around the cap rock, one last maize gold circle that swallows tighten, running laces of thin air back and forth across the fractured sandstone edge. And the variety that I was able to get in of all these collaged. It was a collage image, ink the image, lay it on the plate, put the paper down. And when you make a monotype, it always comes up backwards. So you're always trying to think sort of around how it's going to look when you finish it. This is a piece hanging next door, and it's by Robert Pinsky, again, our laureate poets in the States. And I love this because of the accuracy of his words. I mean, his handwriting is so precise, it's just like him. And it's a poem about watching a man in a suit watching his daughter in a riding ring. A lovely piece. And my resolution after thinking about it was, how do you do this, was to make the ground of the riding rink, the sand or the dirt, and standing on the plate, again subtracting the footprints into it, as though he were standing on it, looking out. And then the last slides I have to show are these of Seamus Heaney. And that, I guess, that conveys you the way in which the poem remains constant. In each of the three pieces, it's the same poem. We reproduced it in the lithography, his handwriting. And it shows you how you can vary the image of illustration with it. He was a delightful person to work with. And we became friends, and we participated in three or four more collaborations, which I don't have with me here, but this one I felt was a particularly successful one. And the one on the bottom right with the black has the chips in it, and you can read the poem very barely, but many people would tell me, I can't read the words, what are they doing there? Why aren't I able to read the words? And I've never felt obliged to put the words into visible. They don't have to be. If you know the poem, then you have it. And if it were hanging in your house or you saw it, you go by and you have the same feeling you do when you go by your bookcase and you see the title of something you really liked. You have that feeling for it. You remember it. And you don't need the words. There's the tree, there's the circle, the void, and there are the chips. And this is the poem. I thought of walking round and round a space, utterly empty, utterly a source, where the decked chestnut tree had lost its place, in our front hedge above the wallflowers. The white chips jumped and jumped and skidded high. I heard the hatchet's differentiated, accurate cut, the crack, the sigh, and collapse of what luxuriated through the shock tips and wreckage of it all. Deep planted and long gone, my coeval chestnut from a jam jar in a hole, its heft and hush become a bright nowhere, a soul ramifying and forever silent, beyond silence, listened for. This was a poem about his mother, who had died recently, and remains one of my favorite pieces in this project. So thank you very much for coming. If there were a question about the making or any aspect of it, I'd be happy to answer them. Well, that's good. Now we can all go drink. But I hope you'll have a chance to see next door, where there are some more on display, and also at the Shell Gallery up on the High Street.
Do you feel that there's, from your input into the project, do you feel that there's a coherent something that all these processes, I mean, I know you said they're all variations of one process, do you feel that there's sort of a hook that the whole thing hangs on, or do you feel that it sort of moved in a more linear fashion through lots of different processes? Is it for you, is it sort of a one-pointed project? Is it a linear thing that changes through time?
I wouldn't use the word linear. It's changed a lot. It's been 40 years. You should see the pieces I'm doing today. I mean, they're very different than what these are. But my goal is to go into the poet's psyche or understand something of the words they've given me, so that I actually become a chameleon to what it is that they're doing. That's why they're so different in their makeup, each of the pieces. Because a lot of the work like this, you get the artist doing his thing and you get the poet doing theirs, and there's really no blending. And I like to think that I've given myself that opportunity to be, in a sense, a magician for the words. It's the magic I'm trying to do is serve the words. So if there's a consistency, it's my desire to serve the words of the poet. And if I can pull something of their personality into it, then that would be a very happy resolution. Such as Octavio Paz, who found himself in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He is such an expressive and exciting man. He was so much more that way than Elizabeth Bishop or Robert Lowell, who kind of contorted and held in. So I thought that the piece and the size of it lent itself to something of his personality. And Seamus, it's sort of the elegance of his words. I was aiming for something that had that sense of balance and elegance. Whereas over here with Allen Ginsberg, you know, it was just so dark and he was so complex, and it was like, he's like a kid, so he gets the crayon and he gets the scratch through because he's not a bright personality, he's a very tortured man. And I made his collage piece of paper like a moon or a ghost that's riding through that space. So to me, there's not a coherency except that I'm trying to serve the poet and serve the words. Does that answer it? Yeah?
Yes, very okay. Much so. Yeah. Has it always been that you have chosen the poets that you wanted to?
I have. Oh, yes.
Has anyone ever contacted you and said, I'd like you to do?
Well, people have, actually. Many people have asked, and it's one of the reasons the project's so peculiar, because I say no. I really want to ask people that I admire or have some interest and some empathy with. It goes on that way. I'm now about to start to do poets in other languages. I'll go to Italy, and I'd love to go to India. I'd love it to be something where this work could be representative of a geological piece of time. These poets, the earliest ones were writing in the 50s. So depending on how many years I get left, you could have a nice span of time of some of the greatest wordsmiths that are going, that are writing. And I do try to help the younger people. There's a beautiful piece across the way by Claire Klug about a loon. And Deborah Waringa also are younger and not as well known, but I think their work deserves a lot of interest. So it's a very eclectic, very personal. Well, again, thank you very much for coming. And I'm around if you have any more to say.
Thank you for coming.